Welcome to Enduring Grief, Healing Practices and True Stories of Living After Loss, where we dive into real, honest conversations about the journey through grief and the support that makes it possible. I'm Sarah Peterson, an LCSW, and in this space, I bring my experience as someone who has walked this path, as well as my work with my nonprofit, Clear Morning. I'm often joined by two incredible guests, Dr. Marla Speyer and Dr. Dean Sharp, both incredible people and physicians who've spent their lives caring for people and have supported me personally on my journey through grief. In our first episode, I'll share my personal story and how I've come to this work, why it matters so deeply to me, and how it might resonate with you. Whether you're navigating your own loss or standing by someone who is, this space is for you. Join me as we uncover the stories, the struggles, and the hope that lead to healing. Let's walk through this journey together. We are so glad to be back together, and we are so glad to be welcoming you, our listeners, into our space. This episode of Enduring Grief with my dear, beloved people, Marlis and Dean again. We are back at their table, looking at the mountains, gazing into each other's eyes, right? And excited. And the peonies are still blooming. We're always, like we said, excited to be together, and today's no different. Today, we are going to talk about natural death versus sudden loss. I think a lot of people experience both. It's important to understand the difference between the two outside of our cultural story around it. So let's just start by defining the two. Sudden loss is an accident, a suicide, an overdose, and it comes with a whole set of responses that are pretty unique to sudden loss, right?
Yes.
What are those responses?
Your neurologic system goes into shock. And how people respond to that shock is fight, flight, and freeze. But it's far more involving your entire body. I mean, all of you. And, you know, it's interesting is thinking about this. I have dealt with people with sudden loss a lot, you know, both as a clinician and I co-led a group on traumatic death and grief. And I've had it happen with my friends, and there's just this incredible range. But my primary response is that the shock is just enormous and overloads the system.
Yeah, I can agree with that. It's just like you sort of have no idea which way is up, and that's a very mild way of putting it, but you just go, everything is done. I remember sitting on the couch the night of Marley's death and thinking, okay, this is the last, or it was the next day, because what I said was, this is the last day of my life. I get to say that I saw her yesterday. And how in the hell can that be?
Well,
and there it was.
Yeah.
True.
But even seeing you now, you're having physical response. Your face is flushing. I'm sure if I were to check your pulse, your heart rate is going up.
It's interesting because I can go into that memory specifically so clearly because I was waiting for somebody that was at my mom and dad's house to take their last bite of lasagna. And then I said, is everybody done eating? And they said, yeah. And I said, here's what I have to say. Because I just felt like I didn't want to say it while anybody was eating. I don't know why, but I remember very consciously thinking it while looking at the room, choosing when to say, that's it. We can't ever say we saw her yesterday. So yeah, I can slip into that pretty easily. Also the shock, I mean, the day of the crash, it took 6 large firemen to hold me back from attacking the driver. That I'm not that strong. I mean, I'm strong, but I'm not that strong. But that, I think, was really pumping through my blood. But then I think some of the only words I could say, well, one of the only words I could say for a really long time was no. I remember a friend taking me up into the woods way up and just like scream. And I'm like, all I want to scream is no. How can this have been? How has this happened? Anything we missed, though, about the response to the sudden loss?
Other than physical?
Yeah, the shaking of the world as you know it.
I think that you can take that apart in each one of aspects of how we function as humans. Mentally, it's unglued. And physically, there's just this neurologic response of changing heart rate, breathing. Okay, someone else has to talk now.
Dean, what are we missing?
I don't think you're missing anything. It's shock, denial, overwhelmed, shut down, you know, unsafe.
Yeah, and as the supporters, we just have to sort of stand by and make sure they're safe.
Right.
Essentially, like not in harm's way.
Non-functioning in any real capacity. Some level, It's the entire autonomic nervous system is what keeps you alive. The fact that your body breathes whether you want it to or not. And even if you hold your breath a really long time, at that time, you will pass out and start to breathe again. But that's what keeps you going, is stuff that's not conscious. And as an organism, at some level, whether you live or die doesn't make any difference. You're even beyond thinking of those sorts of things. It's a complete system crash. And if you're going to use like any change that you go through in your life, there are really a couple of ways. There are changes that you choose. You know, I'm going to get married. At the end of that change, you will find yourself in a new room, married, which is different than the old room, single. And you'll find yourself in a whole new metaphorical storytelling way of talking about who you are and what your life is. And on the way to the new room, you've probably had some time to think about it and to talk about it. And you think you know some of the stakes in the ground or mileposts in the ground by which you'll be able to navigate in the new room. But in my experience, once you get into the new room, it's like all that stuff you read or thought about beforehand is all garbage anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I think that in the situation of a traumatic death, it's like God picks you up and throws you through the door into the new room completely without any mileposts or anything in the ground to guide yourself by. I mean, you are lost in a wilderness with no markers. And that's so much more shocking, dysregulating,
disorienting,
overwhelming than something that was planned. And then there are the times when it's not something like marriage, which I'm sure you're most of the time when you're going to do that, you're kind of looking forward to it. It's a change that you're saying, oh, this might be good. There are a lot of changes we go through in our lives where it's planned, but it might not necessarily be what my choice was. When Marlis and I decided that the time had come, well, Marlis decided the time had come that we downsize, which I've come to agree with completely. Thank God for Marlis in my life. But this was not a change I was ready for or really was very welcoming of. And clearly, the process of downsizing from the house we lived in for 35 years and had accumulated enormous amounts of stuff that needed to go, and moving into the house where we currently live, it was a 2-year process for me to come to terms and feel as though the new place, this new room, was the room where I really wanted to be. And so that's not actually, you know, like somebody dying in the intensity of that change. And yet, it's not something we come to terms with immediately. What I ended up doing, and I think it generalizes to the process, is you move into the new room, my new house, and I don't know where anything belongs. I look out there at the yard, and I didn't plant any of those plants. And I look at the walls, and I didn't paint those walls. I didn't even choose that color, whatever color that is. And so all the ways that I have for navigating in my life, it still is disrupted. It's just I have a little more time and space to come to terms with it. And like I say, it took me 2 years to plant my own plants, build my own patio.
I've thought that a few times. We're back to the bush.
We're back to the bush.
One of our listeners' favorite stories.
Yeah, we're back to the bush.
Back to the bush.
Yeah,
okay.
meaningful bush. Anyway,
So I
really think that, you know, the other topic we were going to go into is a chronic...
Yeah, natural death.
Natural
progression.
This is very much, you know, you have time to get used to it. But let's not kid ourselves. When we find ourselves in a new room, meaning that person has died, it's still a shock.
Yeah, that's true.
So I don't...
I think sometimes can be the shock itself is the shock. because people will think I'm not going to be shocked.
Right.
Then they are shocked, and that becomes the shock, that suddenly they felt so prepared. And what? I'm not fully 100% prepared for this. Now I'm going to spend a lot of time being upset about that disappointment.
Right.
I've talked to a lot, especially folks who've cared for somebody with dementia diagnosis. They think, I'll be so relieved. The suffering will end. This has been so hard and so expensive and so little. This poor person is suffering. And even then, the person dies and they're just brought to their knees by the fact that they turns out they still are very sad.
Yes. And there often is this sense of, it's a bittersweet thing. There's a sense of relief that it's done after so much suffering on the part of a lot of both sides of
Absolutely.
It. And at the same time, that sense of relief is overshadowed often by the sense of loss.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and it's interesting that even it's kind of similar to your Bush. No, I'm just kidding. It's my dad, when he was diagnosed, we knew he was going to die. We didn't want him to die. We didn't get there was no like, oh, this has been such a long, terrible journey. It was like all of this was happening really fast before us. And there was a lot of resistance right up until hours before he died. And yet still at those final hours, I think we all turned the corner toward, what do we need to say?
Yes.
This is the end. We have this beautiful opportunity to be with him in his dying moments. There was, despite it not being what we wanted, we were still able to do some of that very quickly anticipatory grief because we did see it coming. And I think it made all the difference. I mean, especially for him, because he was the one mostly who said the things he needed to say, which was awesome. Granted, he spent the last waking hours watching Monty Python and the Holy Grail, but we won't go there because that was my dad.
I'm proud of the boy.
Yeah, exactly. We're like, oh, so you have 4 hours to live. What should we do with 50% of that time? Monty Python, you got it, Jimmy.
Well, that might be distraction as a desire to avoid the hard feelings of grief.
I think, too, he was so tired. And there was so many connections through that movie, especially with my brother and my uncle who was there, that he was able to just really be sort of saturated in those old memories with them and not have to say much.
Right.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
There is no right way.
No. None. But I think that what we're saying here, too, is that when you have the opportunity to come to terms with it, even if it's in a short amount of time, it can be such a really different, visceral experience, especially.
But I want to acknowledge for the person who has a chronic disease, there are so many shocks. I mean, there's a shock when you get the diagnosis. You go home and it rearranges your whole world, thinking, body. My own diagnosis, I felt very betrayed by my body, by reality, by God. It's a shock. And then, you know, as the first treatment happens, it's a shock. And then when that doesn't work and you go on to the next treatment, it's repeated shocks and grief. Any chronic or natural death involves multiple losses, losses of function, losses of relationship. And so with each one of those, it's both a shock and a grief. And, you know, what I always try to say is that exactly what you said, if you are willing to take the time as someone is living or dying, is to say what it is that you want to say as if they're going to die tomorrow.
Yeah, we don't have to wait.
No, don't wait. Don't.
We don't have to wait.
Don't.
Well, and I think that's a part of the profound difference between something that happens in stages and something that happens all of a sudden. In the sudden death scenario where somebody leaves home and never returns because of an accident, a heart attack, or whatever, violence, oftentimes not only have you maybe not said the most important things that you would like to have said to them for a while, but you may even have been kind of peeved with them or even had some harsher words in departing that you would love to have taken back, and you never will have that opportunity. So it's not only the shock of the loss, but even the secondary wounding of the things that never got said or the things that were said that I'll forever regret.
Totally. And that's honestly our next thing that I wanted to touch on was just the difference in vicarious and secondary trauma with a sudden loss versus a natural death. I think they both can exist for either one, but I think the likelihood of a griever experiencing that secondary trauma after sudden loss is much higher for the things you just said. One of the last things I said to Marley and her brother was that they were both acting like Donald Trump. Now, how terrible is that? Those were really some of my final words, because they were like, they wouldn't stop fighting and they were arguing and tried to get, you know, one up each other. And I said, you guys are acting like Donald Trump. And then they both started bawling.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They were so offended. Anyway, we shouldn't get political, but, you know, things we've said that maybe if I could do the last few conversations with her over again, I probably wouldn't maybe say that.
Well, and the other piece is that while you have that in the acute trauma where you just lose them today, in the long-term stuff, you know, that goes on for months or years sometimes, and you're the caregiver or the person who's showing up each day or the person who's living with that person, supporting them through all of that, there is the real risk that the vicarious traumatization is just finally being overwhelmed by being in the face of their suffering, someone who you love, their suffering over years worth of time. You begin to develop things like compassion fatigue and an ability to be with them because it's so hurtful for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And the guilt or maybe even shame of not being all that they needed at every moment of the way, that you just were too tired to do it. So it's the human journey. What can I say? It's just kind of the reality of it.
We're imperfect.
Yeah, I'm kind of shifting. But I think, too, like with this sudden loss, traumatic loss like that, one thing that I often hear grievers talk about is the what ifs. What if I didn't do this? And what if I didn't do that? Could the whole thing have been prevented, stopped? And the truth is, we'll never know, right? But I struggle, I think, each and every time somebody says, what do I do with that? Because I don't know. You'll just do it until you're sick of doing it, until you come to terms with it's not helpful. I remember my therapist told me to switch the word why to how. That was something. Was that you that told me that? Okay, that was not my therapist. That was just my best friend. But I could logistically explain how this has happened. It happened because we were in this terrible crash. I can explain how one person overdoses. They take too much of a drug. Instead of why? Why didn't I know? Why?
There is no answer.
There is no answer.
There is no answer.
Well, and if there is an answer to that question, it only requires an entity which completely understands absolutely every flux and flow of every particle in the universe at that moment in order to truly know why that happened. Because it is so much more complex and contains so many more moving parts than just your decision that day.
Absolutely. And I did use that tactic to undo the why a little bit, especially in the beginning, because I thought, okay, it was a Sunday morning. Now, if I would have been a churchgoer, I would have been on my way to church instead of on my way to a folk festival. And if I would have then also been a van driver for that church, I would have been out picking up everybody's kids and not just tootly-to my own. That feels psychotic now when I say it like that. But when you must come up with how it is more than the decision I made to go to a folk festival, that's how far I would go back to it. If I would have then, I would have been doing this, my life would have been different, and I probably wouldn't have been on the road. And it revealed to me exactly what you're saying, Dean, is like there are just so many moving parts to what led me to be in that exact spot at that exact moment.
Well, and all the people who were also in the exact spot at the exact moment, including the drunk driver,
right,
who was influenced by things so far beyond your control for him to reach that moment in his life.
Yep.
What it is it's crazy making.
It is crazy making.
It's unanswerable. And my bet is that if we go back to the place where we made the decision to do what we did do, that probably if we put ourselves back in that spot again, we'd make the same decision again.
Sometimes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or well, almost all. Day, those circumstances, that situation, where you were, who you were, what you were trying to do, all of that which went into your decision to do what you did, put yourself back in that moment again,
right,
you'd make the same decision.
Right.
Would not decide not to go. Now, in retrospect, looking back at it, you can say, oh my goodness, I wish we hadn't.
I would decide not to go if I knew.
If you knew, but
I didn't know.
You don't, and you can't.
And that can be for, I wish I would have called my loved one because I didn't realize they were so low. I wish I would have gone. I tried calling 10 times. I wish I would have just stopped by. I wish I tried stopping by. They didn't answer the door. I wish I would have called the police. But in that moment, like you're saying, you took all the information you had in that moment to say, statistically, historically, based on what I know to be true about my life and theirs, this is what I do.
Yeah. It is so much of who you are, so much of who everybody else is. It's impossible to do that. So there's a point at which I think you just have to say that there's an addictive part of doing that to yourself over and over again. And you really have to ask the question, what am I gaining from this?
Absolutely.
And what is this costing me? And really, there are 12-step programs out there. And the first step is I'm out of control around the addiction to wrestling with this silly question. And I just need to stop.
I just need to stop.
I just have to stop doing this. Because, and that was the other thing I was going to say, one of the most important things when you find yourself in a new room, whether that's you just got married because that's what you've always wanted, or you just had a kid, or, you know, all the times we go into a new room because we think it's the right thing to do, or it's a situation where you got sort of pushed and shoved into the new room because of life circumstances, or you get picked up and thrown into the new room by the universe itself, like you were.
Right.
You know, here you were driving on a Sunday morning. Here, we're just going to pick you up and throw you into a new room. The most important thing to do is to get clear about what you want. Getting clear about what you want puts new guideposts into the ground by which to navigate in the new room.
I agree. And what I want doesn't have to be for the rest of my life or even for the day.
No.
It can be, I want a shower because I'm starting to smell and I've got to go in public or whatever the thing. So here's the guideposts that will navigate me to take that. Or I want my hair clean and I don't have the strength to hold my arms up that long. So I'm gonna get it washed at the salon like I did for a year by the grace of my lovely friend. And if you want it, you have to work for it. And you're right. You do have to figure out what you want. Do I want to get dressed today? Do I want to see what it feels like outside? Do I want a cup of coffee? And I think that if we give ourselves permission to start with these low-hanging fruit desires, it's then how you build to seeing bigger desires, bigger wants in life.
Right. Ultimately, you have to find yourself asking deeper questions about deeply held values for you personally. So I want ultimately to be peaceful in my life. I don't have any idea how that's going to happen. I can't even imagine that it might happen. It seems like something so far out of bounds, but it's a guidepost. It's like, how is peacefulness going to find me? How will peacefulness manifest? Can I look and notice the occasional time I feel peaceful?
Well, and I think too, like Marlis was saying in the last episode that we did together about with her mom and kind of thinking about the details of what would be post-death, we can think about what we want. If we're thinking in the course of natural death, what do I want my life to look like when this person is gone? A, will I want to hang on to? What will I want to let go of? What new parts of me do I think might emerge? Do you think that's a fair exercise, Marlis?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'm still back with
when the world has fallen apart trying to figure out what you want. For some reason, what's come up for me is all the families I know right now who've had a teenager take their life. And it's such a huge shock, and all of those questions come up, and it is such a sense of helplessness, powerlessness. And I think that's true with any sudden death, that it puts your sense of helplessness right in front of you. And so when you ask, just figure out, what do you want? What comes to me is, can I just find some ground? And maybe taking a shower is a reasonable grounding.
Or sleep.
Or sleep.
Maybe you haven't slept in what feels like 100 years. Maybe that would be it. And I think, too, that I love that we have this variety of reactions to that, because that's what our listeners will have, is a variety of reactions to the idea of finding what you want amidst such angst. And so if that's not available to you in this moment, when you hear this, or you're thinking of the person you love going, oh my gosh, there's no way they're going to know what they want, that's okay. And just like always consider that these are ideas. This is something that is going to always be available to you as you move through the process. And each one of these ideas that we share with you is part of the process. None of them are to be implemented immediately on day one, hit go, here we are. These are ideas for the process. Because when we say things like trust the process, we're telling you about the process, right?
Yes, it is a journey. And there is no end.
No, it goes on forever, which was one of the conversations I had with a griever yesterday, because this poor griever is having like a really great time right now. And they're just thick with guilt about it. Both parents passed away and they're thick with guilt about it. And I just kind of landed on, it's not going anywhere. I think you're very sad. Well, yes, I'm devastated. And I'm at this part of my life that feels really good. And I have all this support and big things are ahead of me. That's okay too. Because there's also this idea that we have to undo about hurry up and do the hard stuff so that it gets easier faster. And it doesn't work like that either. Oh. Like, you could make it really hard on yourself for the first year, like looking at pictures, even when it brings you to your knees, never sleeping, always doing this, going to work all the time or never going to work at all. And I don't know that it's going to propel you through the process at any different trajectory. It might just simply be harder for the sake of making it harder.
Right.
Well,
I think you always have to ask yourself, what do I think I'm gaining from this particular set of behaviors? Mm-hmm. And what is this set of behaviors costing me? There are so many things that get hardwired into us as children around shame and how things have to be hard, or I haven't really honored the person unless I suffer a lot.
Totally.
And those kinds of stories are really just a story. And I think that we grieve the way we grieve, and people's grief looks different, and how much someone tortures themselves is not a reflection of how much you love the other person.
It's true. And, you know, I often think, I remember starting grad school and wanting to tell my beloved cohort all about who I was as a person, and can't wait to share this with them and that with them. And I remember, you know, in the first couple of weeks sitting there going, all right, Sarah, you've got 3 whole years with these people every Friday for 3 whole years. The time will come when you will get to share the parts when they mean the most. It was really a process. And I almost feel like that sometimes around that acute grief response, where it's like you watch those people suffering, it's suffering for the sake of suffering, instead of it really truly being a transformative grief experience, and never really understanding that there was permission to choose a path. And when I heard this particular person talking about really enjoying parts of their day every day, I was happy for them.
Yeah.
Life goes on.
Well, and that's how we live our most meaningful life in this actual reality, is we learn to live with it. And learning to live with it has to include all the different parts of us. The day before Marley died, I was many things more than her mother, you know, and for a long time after she died, it felt like that was the only thing I was. And if we could like slowly bring back all the other pieces that we were at one time, although they are reshaped, I am still a friend, a sister, et cetera, right?
Right.
So do you think that the support one needs differs between natural death and traumatic loss? Like all the things they've learned from us about compassionate listening and showing up and not having to fix it, like, is that different because somebody died suddenly versus over an extended illness?
No.
Okay.
I think the only thing that's different is that whatever the situation, if someone is down on the floor, incapable of moving, shock system, you got to keep them safe.
Yeah.
You got to not let them get in a car and drive somewhere. You've got to check on them. You've got to be with them. You have to be sure they don't set their house on fire accidentally because they didn't blow the candle out. I mean, people are not thinking or reacting or being in the world in a way which keeps them safe. And so you have to provide that for them. And it doesn't just have to be a traumatic death. It could be losing a beloved job and, you know, the person is wondering whether they can even pay the bills now.
Yeah.
There are many, many kinds of changes that occur in our lives that are sudden and overwhelming that we need others to keep us operating.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, all the other things we've talked about are true. And there's a time and place for all of them.
Yeah. And Marlis, having lost, let's say, your dad to natural death, right? You had plenty of time to say goodbye and potentially say the things you needed to say. I don't know if those all crossed your lips, but you had the chance in a way, different than when your adopted son took his own life. The type of care you received, did it need to be different for those two? Why was it different? Is it because of the relationship? Is it because of the type of death? Like, what could you tell us about the care you received as a griever?
Well, my dad was in his 90s when he died, and his body and his brain were both, I mean, he was ready. I mean, and he had a beautiful death. I was in bed with he and my mother at the time that he died, and the whole family washed his body the next morning before he went for cremation.
Okay, wait, let me pause. What about, I know that you've lost a really close friend to ovarian cancer, right?
Yes.
Probably not ready to go. No. Still a natural death. Still, she was taken too soon. It was a hard death, maybe not a beautiful death always, or maybe it did vary at the end,
right.
But not. Okay, so compare those two.
As a griever.
Yeah, as a griever. What kind of support did you need for her death versus the other? And
you know, if I were going to, and this is my blocked emotion issues, the support that's always helpful for me is to support me in having emotions, because otherwise I'll just stick in doing and taking care of other people as opposed to somebody being present for me.
And did that happen?
Some.
Some.
Yeah. What's interesting in this moment is that the people who were the most supportive in the really difficult grieving situations were other grievers.
Mm-hmm.
People who were grieving the same loss.
The same person.
The same person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I do think, too, and this is one of the things I wanted to touch on, is this hierarchy of loss shows up, too. Because if your friend who died of ovarian cancer, I think it's easy for friends to just sort of get pushed out to the sides. And the society says it's the family who's grieving.
Right.
Friends who, whatever, your life is going to march on the way it always has. We know that's not true, but I think that the story of friendship loss by death is one that is very broken in our culture. I don't think we have a lot of room for what it means to lose your best friend or a very good friend. So that's different. And I think that, did you experience the same thing because Jason was your adopted son and not your biological son? Was
no.
There any difference there?
No.
Okay.
And it's hard for me to tell the difference between not getting the support that I would have wanted and not asking for the support that I wanted, because I tend to be so protected that it feels vulnerable and weak to
Wow. Well, thank you for telling us that. And yeah. And what would you give as advice to the other grievers who identify with that?
Let in the love and support that's available to you. And I think one of the biggest issues for us in our culture is that we are so focused on doing, and I will claim at the top of the
You're the best there. Doer of all the doers in all the doing land.
Yep. That grieving.
That's why she speeds everywhere she goes. She's got so many things to do. You can't waste a moment. Must be going at least five over.
Busted.
I often tease Marlis about driving fast.
And people like me are a challenge because we're in deep grief. I can tell you, my husband, who I'm sitting next to, I wanted a symbol in my yard to remember Jason by. And it's tall, elegant, beautiful, twirling sculpture. And every morning, I remember him, express and meaningfully remember that person.
Yeah.
It's very helpful.
Totally. And I want to back up to what you said, which was that you're a tough case or you're a tough griever.
I'm like, a tough griever.
I think we all are, because I think Dean would be a really tough griever.
Oh, boy, howdy.
I know. It was tough.
No, it was kind of all over.
It was all over.
Oh, yeah.
And as I'm going through the Rolodex of my people, who would be easy?
Nobody.
No, that's true.
I think they're all hard. It's hard because it's completely unique to them.
Yes.
It is.
And therefore, what the hell do I know?
We're back. We're back to the first podcast said every grief is different.
Uh-huh.
And each of us is unique. That's why none of us can give advice to someone else about how they ought to grieve.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not our path. It's not our grief. The person who's supporting, they may do it entirely different. One of the things that's so clear to me is that in the midst of, you know, catastrophic change in people's lives, there are the people who want hugs. Yuck. And then there
Don't
are,
touch me.
Then there are the people who are like, I love to have you here, but over there here,
mm-hmm.
you know, I love having...
You're still describing yourself.
That's what I said. That's what I like. You know, I want to be...
I want to see you.
I want to see you.
I just want to know you're in the house.
I want to know you're in the house.
Don't be in the same room.
Do not be hugging me, you know. Don't be that touching stuff. So, but it's profoundly different. And so I can walk into a room, and if I'm with someone who's not all that interested in being hugged, and I go in and I'm very comfortable not hugging and just being there, it works really great. If I go into a place to be with someone who's grieving, who all they want is to be touched and hugged and have their back rubbed and all of that, because that's how they want to do it, I'm not going to be spontaneously the best person to be there, mm-hmm. because that's just not how I see it. And if someone comes in when my grieving and wants to be all over me, this is a place for a boundary.
Right. You know?
This is not helpful to me.
I mean, it could also answer the question, what do you want?
And it does answer the question.
And that's a low-hanging fruit too,
yeah.
right? That you might actually be able to answer in the throes of it. Do you want to be touched? Yes or no? I think in your visceral acute grief response, that is a question most people can quickly get to the bottom of.
Yeah.
We know.
Yeah.
Do not come near me.
Yeah.
Or, oh my God, please. Or I won't know till you try. Nope. Don't touch me.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we are at that time.
Oh my goodness.
I know. It went by so fast. It always does. It always goes by so quickly.
I guess we'll just have to do this again.
I know. We have to do this again. And on that note, like, please follow us on all the social media platforms, Clear Morning, MourNing. And on those platforms, you can send us questions. Like, I would love to answer questions that people have. So send us your questions. You can also send us your money. You can send us your money right at our website. It's very simple to keep this podcast going. We will be doing a donation drive here pretty quickly. And tell your friends, because as much as we tell you, supporters especially, don't offer advice to your grievers, I think we could say offer this one piece of advice. Listen to this podcast. Right.
Perfect.
I mean, It is why we're doing it. And people are telling their friends, people are telling the people who are crossing their paths in grief, hey, try this out. And the feedback we're getting is really incredible. So to our listeners, thank you for giving us a shot. Tamar Listendine, thanks for doing this with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Enduring Grief, Healing Practices and True Stories of Living After Loss. We hope today's conversation brought you comfort, understanding, or simply the assurance that you're not alone in your grief. If you found this episode helpful, please share it with someone who might need to hear it and subscribe as a way to stay connected. We'll be back next week with more personal stories and practical guidance for navigating the complexities of loss. Until then, take care of yourself and remember, there's no right or wrong way to grieve. You have the freedom to mourn in the way that feels true to you.